This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear excerpts from a recent panel of lawyers, activists, and elected officials from the Detroit, Michigan area titled Alternatives to Policing, in which they address the pressing questions confronted by policing in America. What is the abolition movement? What does defunding really mean? How do police reform measures and actions to hold police accountable fit into the abolition defund movement?
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
One of the most pressing issues of the day is policing in America, notably how to confront the disproportionate unconstitutional use of force, shootings, arrests, and prosecutions of Black Americans and other people of color with impunity. Can it be reformed, or must it be dismantled? On December 6, our own Julie Hurwitz facilitated a panel discussion at Wayne State Law School called Alternatives to Policing. It was sponsored by the National Lawyers Guild, the Michigan Coalition for Human Rights, the Coalition for Police Transparency and Accountability, and the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and I'm here with Julie to introduce highlights from this important event. Julie, please tell us a bit about each speaker.
Thanks, Heidi. The panelists at this event, attended by over 250 people, were Aaron Keith, Michigan Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Andrea Ritchie, and Michigan State Senator Stephanie Chang. Aaron Keith is the managing policy counsel for Detroit Justice Center and an outspoken advocate on behalf of the abolition defund movement in Detroit and around the country. She presents a thoughtful and clear-headed analysis of the fact-based evidence in support of this movement. Michigan Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib discusses her efforts to fight from within the U.S. legislature to redirect resources away from policing and other militaristic budget items and toward a broader understanding of public safety to include the need to confront head-on poverty, homelessness, health care, mental illness, and the criminalization of people of color. Andrea Ritchie is an attorney, writer, gay activist, and nationally recognized expert on policing and criminalization. She addresses the particular impact that policing in America has on Black, women, queer, trans people, and discusses her recently released book, No More Police. And Michigan State Senator Stephanie Chang discusses her efforts within the Michigan legislature to introduce statewide laws that would create a modicum of accountability around the use of force, the decertification of quote-unquote bad cops, chokeholds, no-knock warrants, foot pursuits, and body-worn cameras. Both Congresswoman Tlaib and Senator Chang, in their talk, emphasize the critical importance of grassroots community organizing to achieve the goals espoused by the abolition defunding movement. It was a very lively and exciting and inspiring conversation.
Thanks so much, Julie, for that introduction. We turn now to the panelists, beginning with Aaron Keith, followed by Rashida Tlaib, Andrea Ritchie, and then Stephanie Chang. Let's take a listen.
My name is Aaron Keefe. I currently serve as the Managing Policy Counsel at the Detroit Justice Center. And I really wanted to ground our conversation tonight in data. data that's relevant to our community here in Metro Detroit, data that really colors why this topic is so important, why it's not just a matter of opinion, and why it really can't wait, why we really need alternatives to policing now. And so first, I kind of wanted to give a background as to why I became someone who identified with abolitionist ideas. I began to align myself with abolitionist principles when I started asking the question, why? Why does my community look like this? Why isn't there money to invest in neighborhoods? Why does the public safety conversation seem to always lead back to more police when I see so many other areas that need attention for my community to feel safe? When I was in law school and Michael Brown was killed, and then Freddie Gray was killed, and then Tamir Rice was killed, and then Sandra Bland was killed, and then Philando Castile was killed, I asked why. Why am I in the classroom discussing this shooting as an analytical exercise? Why are people trying to justify these killings? Why are these officers getting off? Why are there more protections for those with a blue uniform than with brown skin? When I worked in the juvenile justice system and had opportunities to represent youth accused of delinquency, I asked why. Why are there more school resource officers than social workers? Why is there more state-of-the-art surveillance tech in school than state-of-the-art trauma intervention programming? When I worked in the adult system back in Detroit representing clients, I asked why again. Why are people whose first infraction was a traffic offense sitting in prison now for something else? Why do I have clients who have been stopped by officers 10, 20, or 30 times to have as many traffic offenses as they have? Why is what police spend a lot of the time and resources doing Detroit's purportedly a more violent city and more crime-ridden than all of those other places? Why is it that we're spending so much time on traffic stops? And if you follow the whys and are open to the complexities, I think it leads you towards abolition, because you can't simply reform a system that's functioning as it was designed to function and that has had its origins in slave patrols protecting whiteness and what white folks believe to be their property. And so with that, I want to again turn to the data. Why use the word abolition in the first place? Well, abolition can be defined as the act of ending a pattern, practice, behavior, or institution. It can apply in a multitude of contexts to eradicate a multitude of harms, especially those of a systemic nature, where merely reforming such a system would essentially allow those harms to persist. We have to work towards creating a world where society's reliance on police is wholly unnecessary. And if we're too scared to name that goal and to say it, we won't get there. Why use the term defund? Well, advocates use terms like reallocate resources for years to no avail, while police budgets grew excessively. Defund is another way of saying divest. When we divest, we have money to invest. So to divest from policing, divesting involves removing money from the criminal punishment system, carceral bureaucracies, and their actors. This can mean divesting from policing, but might also include divesting from jails, prisons, detention centers, and other problematic private actors like bail bonds companies, to invest in communities. Investing involves moving resources to communities to fund things that would in fact make those communities safer and more equitable. It allows communities impacted by over-policing and mass incarceration to drive the solution. So when we look at how the killings in 2020 began that involved police violence, 94 people were killed after a mental illness or welfare check. 121 people were killed after a traffic stop. 188 people were killed after nonviolent domestic disturbance, and 251 people were killed after other nonviolent offenses, which means that 58% of killings began when police responded to nonviolent incidents. I'll say that again. 58% of killings began when police responded to nonviolent incidents. When we look at, again, why is divest invest necessary? Increasing police funding does not reduce crime, and specifically does not reduce homicides. A review of law enforcement funding over time demonstrates that increased police funding does not result in decreased crime. According to the National Police Funding Database in Little Rock, Arkansas, they had more than twice as many police per 1,000 residents as other similarly sized cities. Richmond, Virginia had almost three times as many. Despite this overrepresentation of police, Richmond's 2021 homicide number increased by 60% over the five-year pre-pandemic average, and Little Rock's homicide rate increased 73% above the five-year pre-pandemic average. Cities basically are showing us in their own data that the number of police that they have and the police funding increasing does not reduce homicides and does not make those communities safer. Now let's take this to Detroit. In fiscal year 2020, Detroit police spent $317 million on the Detroit Police Department's general fund, far more than any other department, including housing or health. Including other funds such as state and federal grants, the total DPD budget for fiscal year 20 was $330 million. That means we're spending one out of every $3 from the city's general fund on policing, when we have so many other things that need to be supported. Why does this matter? Well, the Detroit Police Department is not effective at keeping our communities safe. Detroit has one of the lowest rates for solving violent crimes in the country. 41% was the DPD's average arrest rate for murder investigations from 2010 to 2017, and 12% was the DPD's average arrest rate for rape investigations in that same time period. Half of all criminal prosecutions in Michigan are for minor traffic offenses, like driving with a suspended license. Many of these offenses directly criminalize poverty and do nothing to improve public safety. According to a 2020 task force report, driving without a valid license was the third most common reason that people were booked into jails in Michigan. Driving without a valid license was the most serious charge at jail admission for 12% of Black men and 15% of Black women, compared to just 6% for both white men and women, according to Pew data. And there's no correlation between the number of police officers and crime rates. So why is this our reality? Well, it's not just ours. It's the reality of a lot of our neighboring municipalities. Let's look at Dearborn. Dearborn's total police budget is $47.1 million. As the police budget goes up, community resources have seen their budget shrink, including water, sewer, parks and recreation, public works, libraries, housing, and downtown development. Up from only 25% in 2007, the Dearborn Police Department now receives 35% of the city's general fund. As police funding takes up more and more, other departments need to become self-sustaining or lose funding. And how do police use that money? Well, in 2021, Dearborn Police spent $1.96 million on weapons and $2.37 million on overtime and holiday pay. Meanwhile, as you can see here, Dearborn shuttered its health department in 2013 and has had inadequate resources to respond to flooding over the last year. But what else do we know? We know that 73% of all arrests in Dearborn are made in a region that borders Detroit, and that Black people are disproportionately targeted. 54% of people arrested are Black. Only 4% of Dearborn residents are Black. What does this mean? Dearborn PD spends millions of dollars each year to criminalize and arrest Black Detroiters. The police are not effective at addressing harm. Over 80% of the Border Crime Initiative team's arrests were for misdemeanors. Serious crimes went down in 2020 and arrest rates were even lower. 229 auto thefts were reported in 2020, but only 46 arrests resulted. Lastly, accountability for Dearborn has found that only 10% of arrests in Dearborn are conducted for reasons of violence or interpersonal harm. We can also look at Livonia. The total police budget in Livonia was $26.5 million. What does that pay for? What does Livonia's general fund pay for? Two out of every $3 in Livonia's budget is spent on police and fire. In 2021, Livonia spent $283 per capita on police. We can also look at what they're doing with their money. In 2019, Livonia PD made 4,700 arrests, but issued over 30,000 minor citations. 60% of those arrested were Black. And again, Livonia's population is less than 5% Black. So who is Livonia policing? Black and brown people. Livonia spends $6 million more on police than on parks, libraries, public works, the court, and downtown development combined. And lastly, we can look at Ferndale. Of the 18,504 calls to service received by Ferndale PD last year, Only 8.7 were labeled high priority, robbery or assault. The rest were civil matters and complaints, abandoned vehicles, etc. In 2020, Ferndale police arrested 528 people. Of these, 35 involved use of force. For comparison, Livonia police used force 34 times in 2019, but made 4,700 arrests. Ferndale's population is 6.3% Black, but 59.5% of the people arrested in Ferndale in 2020 were Black. This indicates what many of us who live in this area already know. Ferndale is policing Black visitors to the city for mostly minor infractions. So what could we fund instead? I know that data seemed kind of bleak, but let's turn it around. What could we do instead? Well, first, I think, and DJC thinks, we could build 18 restorative justice centers for $17 million apiece. We could provide a $10,000 child care tax income credit to 700 families when 48% of children in Detroit are living in poverty. We could create mental health and rehabilitation facilities with beds for 244 patients. We could create 10,000 living wage jobs for people in the city. We could house every homeless person in Detroit in $90,000 homes and give a $5,000 tax credit to many homes facing foreclosure. Within 2 years, we could renovate and modernize all DPSCD schools. Other communities are already doing this. Ann Arbor recently put steps in place to create what they're calling an unarmed 911 response program, reimagining what it could look like to have someone be able to respond to emergencies that's not a police officer. We've also seen in other counties innovative things like safety patrol handing out vouchers for vehicle repairs instead of tickets. We've seen school boards voting unanimously to remove police from public schools so that they have money to do things like have nurses in their school, have social workers in their school, have restorative justice programming in their school. So this is not far-fetched. It's just up to us to educate ourselves and learn what we could do instead. And lastly, I want to just drive home this point. Defunding the police promotes accountability, okay? It reveals overspending. It shows where overfunding is not working to rebut carceral narratives that departments just need more money to be effective. It promotes refunding communities by encouraging an analysis of what services are being neglected to fund policing in order to redirect this funding towards community resources and evidence-based solutions. And lastly, it empowers the people. It allows community members to hold police accountable for their performance or lack thereof, to hold municipalities accountable for their spending on police, and gives the community grounds to advocate for changes to policing and abolition. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Julie. Thank you.
A lot to digest, a lot to think about, a lot to talk about. I'm now going to invite Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you all so much. That was very powerful. So I'm excited to be with all of you tonight for this really important discussion that I'm incredibly passionate about. As many of you all know, right now, many of my colleagues are moving with such urgency when it comes to policing, but you don't see that same urgency when it comes to passing some sort of form of universal healthcare in our country. I do want to thank the incredible host, Damon Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State, Detroit Coalition for Police Transparency and Accountability, of course, our amazing Detroit and Michigan National Lawyers Guild, and the Michigan Coalition for Human Rights for really having the courage to have this conversation that I feel like many of our neighbors across the country want to talk more about. It's great to be here with all the experts and the folks on the ground who give credibility to the work I am doing and some of my other courageous colleagues that are doing, moving away from this conversation that somehow policing is going to erase homelessness and poverty and various broken systems in our country. We all know, and I know I'm speaking to the choir, that we can argue that realizing real public safety is much bigger than simply the absence of gunshots. In my mind, it is the presence of justice and the extension of opportunity to live and thrive to every American and not just the most privileged among us. When we talk about public safety, we need to be talking about poverty and hunger and homelessness, our education, our healthcare system, mass transit, clean air and water. We can't police away homelessness and poverty. We can't police away the rise of domestic violence across our nation. We can't police away the mental health crisis that every corner of our country is experiencing. It is so sad to hear that a parent gets a call from a school that their child is not at the counselor's office, but in custody of a police officer. Criminalization will not create a thriving community. We need real investments in our community. That's how we create safe communities. And we understand that we have to examine, for me and many others that I know talk about this, we have to examine the budget priorities that we have at all levels of government. You heard it from Detroit Justice Center. In 2020, one out of every $3 from the city of Detroit's general fund was spent on policing, greatly overshadowing our investment around education, public health, and other items that I feel like can really address the goal of making sure that we all have the ability to thrive. You know, when I see 48% of our children in Detroit are living in poverty, I don't know how people don't understand that alone. If we can address that alone, we can start seeing much more effective, meaningful transformation of having, again, thriving communities. You know, the same thing is happening at the federal level. I know my colleague on the panel talked about what's happening at local governments, but I couldn't even tell you how many bills we've had to vote in the House over the past year that basically just threw money at police in hopes that they'll address the public safety problems that we have that we can't inherently solve by, just calling the police. Meanwhile, we still don't have universal health care. You know this. Meanwhile, we still don't have school funding that is equitable. To put it in perspective, I just want folks to know in 2019 in our country, we spent approximately $255 billion on policing, prisons, and courts. If we counted as a military, America's police would be the third largest on earth, with a budget greater than the militaries of India, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and France combined. Three of which have large nuclear weapons programs. So we have the largest military on the planet, bigger than all of the other top global militaries combined. Our police forces would count as, the third largest on earth. We have more people in prison than any other country in the world. Essentially, we have an addiction, y'all, to criminalization and policing. And we're feeding that addiction, right? Not us in this room, but many of folks in power, they're depriving our communities of the resources that we need to truly be able to thrive. We're not in some sort of room looking at polling like many of my colleagues or trying to, no, we really truly are trying to save lives. And the way we do it is investing in our communities and making sure we all have the ability to thrive. So I just thank you all so much for continuing to speak truth to power. Many of the panelists here, many of the folks that have been in the trenches talking about this before I even came along, but I want you all to know again, thank you for giving credibility to many of my families all across my district that say the same thing. What about my house that I'm literally getting ripped apart from me because I'm being overtaxed? What about, you know, my neighbor who's still looking for some sort of access childcare so she can go to work? What about all of these things that I think, again, are connected to really making our community safer? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rashida. I know there are going to be a lot of questions about short-term, long-term strategies and what's viable now, what's viable within the context of working in the system as opposed to outside the system. We're now going to hear from Andrea Ritchie, who I expect will address some of those questions for us.
Thank you so much, Julie and Congresswoman Tlaib and also Aaron. It's really an honor and privilege to be here. I do want to honor the original stewards still present and resisting on this land, the Anishinaabe, Odawa, Wyandot, and Potawatomi people. I also want to thank you all for having me here in Detroit. I'm a recent relocator, a longtime fan. I've been coming to the Allied Media Conference here in this very auditorium sometimes since 2007 and have been shaped and learned so much from the communities here in Detroit. For folks who can't see me on the virtual screen, I am a very light-skinned Black woman with curly hair, and I'm wearing all black because I moved here from New York, so obviously. I also always want to introduce myself not only as a Black woman, but as a lesbian, an immigrant, and a survivor of state and interpersonal violence, both because some of those things are not so obvious by looking at me, but also because they deeply have shaped how I approach these issues in many ways. And I have spent the past more decades than I want to count documenting, organizing, advocating, litigating, agitating around the violence of policing, particularly as experienced by people in my community through the lens of the experiences of Black women, girls, queer, and trans people who experience the violence of policing in many of the same ways that we often talk about. Most folks don't know that Black women are the demographic most likely to be killed by police when unarmed of any demographic group. So many times we talk about how Black cisgender assumed to be heterosexual men are perceived to be a threat by police, but clearly that statistic shows that Black women are equally, if not more, perceived to be a threat, and also experience very gender and sexuality specific forms of violent policing, including sexual violence, which is the second most reported form of police violence after use of force, policing of pregnancy and parenthood. Black women in some states are up to 10 times more likely to be drug tested during prenatal visits and when giving birth. So we talk about driving while Black, walking while Black. We don't talk about giving birth while Black, and we should, or having an abortion while Black, or having an unplanned termination of a pregnancy while Black. And also very much experience policing in the context of calls for help. And so we've talked about mental health crisis response. We've talked about domestic violence response. Those responses are, particularly for Black women, girls, and trans people, very often the site of violence by police rather than protection or abandonment to violence. And so those are the realities that really shaped my coming to be an abolitionist, because when I often say that when you look at policing through the experiences of Black women, girls, and trans people, you get much more quickly to the reality that there is no protection in the system, that there is only more violence, policing, and punishment, and that policing also happens beyond the actual police, that they happen at the hands of the family police, they happen at the hands of the medical police, they happen at the hands of the welfare police, they happen at the hands of every institution is about policing, regulating, and punishing, surveilling, and excluding structurally Black women, girls, and trans folks from safety and the things that they need to access to achieve safety. And so some of the statistics that you heard, I wanted to throw in on because they really shape my and my co-authors' approach to the issue as well, which is that fewer than 4% of police calls, or between 4 and 10% of police calls, are for things that we think of police are needed for, like domestic violence, you know, assault in progress, homeless, burglary in progress, et cetera. So 90% of what cops are doing is not what we think of them as doing, as like running to the scene of violence and valiantly interrupting it in their capes. And then the other piece that's really important is that the vast majority of survivors of violence never call police in the first place. 43% of domestic violence survivors and 75% of people who experience sexual assault aren't using the system that we're pouring $225 billion a year into to address the violence they're experiencing. People are experiencing violence of tremendous proportion and choosing nothing over police. That in and of itself is a crime. And I think that is where we need to be focusing on why we need to be looking for something more and better for ourselves as survivors and for the people in our communities who are experiencing violence. So I would say that, you know, we called No More Police, which I co-authored with my Interrupting Criminalization co-founder, Mariam Kaba. I'm sure some of you have heard of her. Today, she was declared a Freedom Scholar, which I can't think of anything more appropriate to call her. And, you know, we made 3 points in No More Police, a case for abolition. The first is that cops don't stop violence. And you heard many of the stats that we cite, many of the stats that Aaron mentioned, as well as the ones about police not serving survivors and instead perpetrating violence against survivors, including sexual violence. One of the primary sites of sexual violence by police is when they're responding to calls for help. So literally cops will respond to a call for help around a sexual assault case and commit sexual assault in that context. So we're doubling up the violence. It's not just that we're not getting a response to the violence, we're actually adding into it often. So cops don't stop violence, they add their own violence into it. So one of the stats that we, you know, when we're looking at kind of crime stats or violence stats, we're not thinking of how many of homicides or sexual assaults or physical assaults are being perpetrated by police. And the police themselves know that they don't stop violence. It was something that was very interesting to me when I taught a course on policing at UIC Chicago, is that their own textbooks say they don't stop violence. Their own textbooks say the number of cops, the response time, the manner of deployment, none of that stops violence. And it's a response after the fact. And then you saw the rates at which there's even any kind of progress as the system defines progress. We also argue, as Aaron said, that cops can't be reformed. The system is doing exactly what it was set up to do. If it could be reformed, the things we've been doing over the last 100 years would have produced something. But instead, every single time there's a commission, there's an inquiry, there's a set of recommendations, they look the same, they're the same. Sometimes we throw in a little technology, but essentially we're producing the same recommendations and trying to repeat the same efforts to reform something that is doing exactly what it was set up to do. And so, and then the third thing that we argue is that we can and we are creating safety without policing and punishment and surveillance and exile. And we're doing that. There's data, again, that makes it really clear that if you invest in community safety organizations, homicides go down. But we're always given the choice of police or no police. And the key thing about abolition, it is about divesting from policing, not just financially, but ideologically and emotionally, breaking the addiction that the Congresswoman mentioned too. And it's about divesting police of funding, but also of power and legitimacy. But it's also divesting them from our imaginations. And really the fact that we can't imagine anything but cops or nothing. And in fact, the studies show that when we put something else or many other things in place that people have mentioned, that communities thrive and violence goes down. So that's the case that we make. And I think I will stop there and pass it to back to the Madam Moderator and come back to you later.
If you're just tuning into Law and Disorder, we're listening to presentations from a recent panel called Alternatives to Policing, held in early December at Wayne State University Law School. Julie, after the panelists gave their presentations, you asked them to talk more about the issue of police reforms.
Yes, Heidi. As soon as the speakers finished their presentations, we launched into a very interesting conversation on many topics, including the intersection and contradictions between using legislation, on the one hand, to enact moderate limited police reforms, while at the same time engaging in grassroots movement organizing for abolition and defunding. And I addressed the panel and asked them to talk about how the use of reforms can assist the long-term goal and vision of abolition on the one hand, and also why those laws don't go far enough.
Let's take a listen to what the speakers had to say.
From a variety of views, although many of these views coincide with one another, yet they also seem to contradict one another. And I'd like to give our panelists an opportunity to discuss between yourselves and Congresswoman Tlaib behind us, me, the intersection and contradictions that exist between, on the one hand, using legislation to enact limited or moderate police reforms on the one hand, and the movement in the streets and policy centers for abolition and defunding, a revamping of the entire institution on the other hand. I guess I'd throw it out to Andrea to start with how you might view, and then you can talk to one another, which I would encourage you to do. How do you view the use of reforms, or do you see any value in the strategy of reforms to enact some modicum of, if not actual change, but some semblance of accountability?
have so much to say about that. We named the chapter in our book Reform, spelled R-E-F-O-R-M, to show that basically reform is about recreating the same thing in a different shape. We want to make sure that the changes that we're pursuing are not doing that. We're not creating something we need to tear down, we're going to come back and need to tear down, or that's going to produce more harm in a different form. So I guess I want to use my 3 minutes to sort of put at the center this question of an alternative to policing. And my co-author, Mariam, always really, at the beginning of the uprising, really when this conversation started becoming more widespread, saying we have to stop using the word alternative to police because it keeps policing at the center. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a replacement that looks like police or that feels like police. So maybe we don't want the cops to respond to a mental health crisis, but we want someone else to respond in a similar way, right? Show up, take someone away. Maybe not put them in a jail cell, put them in coerced treatment, incarcerate them in a psych ward. It's another form of incarceration. It's another form of surveillance, containment, and control. And the definition of abolition is no policing, surveillance, containment, control, or exile of any kind. So I think if we think about, or the same for homelessness, right? You know, maybe the cops shouldn't show up and sweep people, but we're going to get someone else to come and warehouse them somewhere else. Instead of thinking of an alternative to police, an exercise that organizers in Minneapolis and many other places have done is to think, let's look at where we see cops in our community now. And let's think, first of all, if anything needs to be there. And if instead the problem they're addressing could be addressed by meeting someone's basic need, instead of moving someone to a warehouse when they're unhoused, why don't we just have housing? Instead of waiting for someone to reach a crisis point because there is no universal national health care, what if we just made sure that everyone had access to everything they needed to address their mental health needs? What if we got 1,000 miles ahead of a crisis instead of organizing our lives around the crises that our current conditions are producing? So I think that's what stepping us out of this notion of alternatives to police enables us to do, is to really parse out what is just the fact material needs not being met that could be met with money that the cops are looting from our budgets and communities to the tune of 40 to 60%. And if someone needs to be there, what do they need to be doing? And how can we be training ourselves to be there for each other rather than delegating that to a state that's going to engage in policing in one form or another?
I'm going to present the same question to Senator Chang and Congresswoman Tlaib. I don't know who of you wants to speak first.
I don't know if folks have looked at Cori Bush's People's Response Act. I don't know if you would call it reform or not, but it's unarmed first responders to 911, you know, and having done 911 diversion programs, you know, doing housing security programs. So all of this would be housed under HHS. So it's a little bit, you know, moving us away from that addiction of even thinking about policing and moving towards direct human services. But it would basically establish what they would call a community safety division within the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm a co-sponsor of it, truly believe in this. When pandemic happened, I introduced the ABC Act, where we not only did, you know, 2,000 per month while folks were struggling during that time, but we created kind of like an AmeriCorps type first responder corps that would basically go around the most vulnerable communities. And we defined it in a way that would include communities like ours, and helping them through the everyday challenges of living during the pandemic. And so these are things that I think myself and many of my colleagues are moving towards, is talking about health and human services, talking about funding those kinds of programs. Even when you look at the People's Response Act, which was really in co-authored with Movement for Black Lives, and in there, it really is around moving towards, you know, the youth and families, survivors of violence, exiting away from incarceration or criminal supervision, even in those kinds of spaces. It is direct funding towards those kinds of programs. And again, moving away for that call not to be going towards police, but actually having someone that is, equipped or better equipped to deal with the trauma that's usually right behind those calls. So anyways, I think those are the kinds of approaches that myself and many of my colleagues are doing. At the same time, you know, I'm trying to ban facial recognition technology. got a full ban and then banning it from public housing. Specifically, they're putting that racist technology on some of our, you know, on our public housing. But these are just some of the ideas that our many of my colleagues are going. So, of course, I know, Julie, you like us getting rid of the immunity, but I think some of us are, of course, supportive of getting rid of qualified immunity, but we're also moving away from even talking about policing like one of our panelists discussed.
Erin, do you want to comment on this intersection?
Oh,
Stephanie?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is we've got to be talking about it in whatever, it's all important. So it's kind of what I think is that folks on the ground using, you know, words like defund and abolition, you know, obviously it fits with the work that you're doing, but in terms of the work that, you know, that we need to also do in the meantime of like, let's try to enact some policy change that will save some people's lives by, we can save lives by banning no-knocks and by banning chokeholds and by ensuring that we hold bad cops accountable when they use excessive force to make sure that they can no longer be police officers, right? So we know that we can save lives by doing those things. And so for me, that's why I don't think it should be one or the other in terms of people's lives are worth saving. And so doing the work that, you know, I'm trying to focus on right now in the sort of immediate term, I think is really critical. And at the same time, having these larger conversations about, of course, you know, we need to fund housing. And that's a big focus of mine as well. And focusing on making sure that we're adequately funding our education system is, of course, a huge priority as well. And making sure that we're providing adequate and funding for all of the things that people mentioned before is huge and absolutely critical. And so, but of course, we've got to have folks who can shape a budget that reflects our values. And so I'm really hopeful that we can do that. You know, I'm a big believer in sort of like an inside outside strategy, right? And that's how I've been able to move other legislation in the past that's been meaningful. And so our message does not always have to be the same. And in fact, it's sometimes okay. I think sometimes it's better when we're using the words that resonate with the audiences that we're talking to. And so if I need to go convince, you know, more moderate colleagues of certain things that need to get done, I've got to use the words that appeal to them if we're going to try to achieve the results that we need. And at the same time, you know, we've got to push for bigger, bolder solutions as well. So I think that it's got to be all of the above in order to achieve both short-term wins, medium-term wins, and long-term wins.
Erin, I want to add something to this question. And that is within the context of this intersection and the inside-outside strategy that Stephanie just mentioned, I'd like to have you comment on why the words abolition and defunding. What are the strategic advantages or disadvantages to that terminology within the context of this movement? Is it a trigger? Does it not possibly provoke some of the moderate people that say Stephanie's trying to communicate with to just get stuck on the terminology? So could you comment on that?
So I'll answer both questions. I'll take your second one first.
Okay. In 3 minutes,
I'll do it. So first, I get this question a lot. Why use the term defund? It's so inflammatory. Why use the term abolition? It's so inflammatory. First of all, again, as I mentioned in my slide, we've been saying reallocate resources forever. We were saying that before George Floyd was murdered. We were saying that before the Black Lives Matter movement even started. We were using those words and people were saying, that's nice. It would be nice if we had money to do that. It would be nice if we had money to invest in our schools. It would be great. But where would that money come from? Oh, that's just so pie in the sky. It's so unrealistic. The moment advocates started using words like defund and abolish, people started listening. The reason we're in this room having a conversation about this years after this movement has started, years after the murder of George Floyd, is because we use words like defund and abolish. And I think what's needed more so than changing the terminology is educating people on what the terms mean and educating people about what they stand for and what really does it mean to abolish the police, or what would it even look like to reallocate resources through defunding? By show of hands, how many of you all ever heard the term reform the police or defund the police in high school? Raise your hand if you heard that term. Okay, so we have like three people. That's the problem. We're not learning. We're not educating ourselves on what our options even are. Our community members don't know what their options even are. They just want the violence to stop. They want the shooting to stop. They want the blight to stop. And that's reasonable. That's very reasonable for people who live in this community. I myself am a Detroiter. It's reasonable to want better for your community. But when we think that our only option is policing, we stop ourselves from having real conversations about real solutions. And so to end, you asked a specific question, which I wrote down, is there value in reforms, right? There are two things that I wanted to highlight here briefly. First, we have to look at what we consider a reform. When we're pouring money into policing and enhancing their budget to do things like implicit bias training or to hire more officers who then can be trained in social work but still have a policing background, when we're bloating their budgets even more and calling that reform, that is not actually helping to transform anything. It's just like Andrea said, reforming the same thing we had, right? So when we look at practices that center public safety, not policing, we have to ask ourselves, are those practices, are the things that we're advocating for inherently abolitionist? Do they help propel us towards abolitionist goals? Because the question is, there's going to be a value in a lot of things. There's a value in this phone, right? If you think that the only thing you can have is a cell phone, there's a value in this phone. This phone costs some money. But what if instead you could have this whole building? You could own this whole building. What would you choose? You would choose the building because you know there's more value in the building than there is in having this phone. And so the reality is there's more value in abolition as a whole for our society than there is in a minor reform. That's just a tweak. It's going to save some lives, but it's not going to save our society as a whole. So,
Andrea, I'm going to turn to you to start this. And I want to talk about not reforms so much, but civil rights laws themselves that are enacted to enforce the Constitution and to provide some modicum of accountability for the glaring abuses of rights that go on by police. And as a practicing civil rights lawyer myself, who specializes in police misconduct litigation, what are your views on how civil rights laws and private police misconduct litigation fit into this picture and this strategy?
I guess I just want to say that quickly on the word the demand around defund is that, you know, it says exactly what we want. We want to take money from here and put it over here. That's the power of it. And it's so powerful, the president keeps having to say it. And people keep having to declare the movement dead. If it's not powerful, you don't have to keep declaring it dead. So I just want to name that. And then I just do want to say that not all reforms are created equal, and that I have spent a lot of my time litigating, trying to do harm reduction. What can I do to reduce the harm of this system today while we build something else? That was my entire goal. I've been a member of the Lawyers Guild for 2 decades. I've been litigating that long. Turns out all the policy changes I won the most extensive policy changes, the NYPD patrol manual around interaction with trans people. I got 800 people off a sex offender registry in New Orleans and in Louisiana. I made precedent about, you know, treatment of discrimination by police against trans people. Lots of policy change. The same cops I sued, I never lost a case. The same cops I sued are still on the street doing the same thing. In fact, I came face to face with four of them when we were being tear gassed in 2020. I was like, oh, you, I see. Glad I sued you. So, I think, and there are many times when those policy changes would happen and then clients would call me and say the same thing is still happening. You can get the most progressive policy change on paper. The thing is, cops aren't there to follow rules. They know the rules aren't for them. That's a quality of the system being doing exactly what it was set up to do. So I don't think we can sue our way out of the problem. And I don't think that changing policy, I tried, and many others along me have tried, changing policy through litigation is the way out of it. But it is a way of achieving reparations for people who have been harmed by police. And that is really important because we do want to achieve reparations now for people who have been harmed now by police. It's insufficient often, it's inadequate. And then sometimes we can advance the reforms that do bring us closer to abolition, the ones that take power, resources, legitimacy, and weapons away from cops. So if I can do litigation that takes a weapon away from a cop where he can't put someone on a sex offender registry for saying, I'll offer you oral sex for $50, that's a weapon I've taken away. And that is a reform in a litigation that is worth pursuing. And that has made a material change in the lives of the people who were subject to that requirement before. So I think we have to be very discerning about which reforms we're advancing that will actually produce material changes and save lives and bring us closer to the world we want, and which ones are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And I think that's true in the civil litigation that we're doing and in the policy advocacy that we're doing. And I don't get me wrong, I have made mistakes on that path. And I have fallen prey to like, oh, we should have a registry of cops who have been engaged in sexual violence so they don't keep going from one department to the other. But in the end, that's not going to stop the sexual violence from happening. That's an after the fact thing. And you have to prove in a prosecution or get a substantiated complaint. Both of those things happen in 1% of cases. So now 90% of cases of cops engaged in sexual violence are still not being dealt with because 1% are on this registry. And then that's legitimating the whole thing. So I used to advocate for that. I stopped doing it because I saw it wasn't going to produce the material change that survivors of police sexual violence like myself need, which is the violence to stop before it happens. And certainly that there needs to, yeah, that we need to take away the tools and the power that cops have to engage in it in the first place. So reparations, absolutely. Take tools away, absolutely. But we're not going to sue our way out of the problem.
We have some people who have microphones who can bring the mic to you. It looks like Sarah at the back of the room.
Thank you all for being here and everyone who's in attendance as well, virtually and in person. I guess if I formulated my question in my head in a good way is the similarities and differences with abolitionists, the OG abolitionists, slavery abolitionists, and police abolitionists, because at one time people were saying, oh, you can't get rid of slavery, you abolitionists are crazy, and then, well, you can't get rid of police, what are we going to do about A, B, C, D, you abolitionists are crazy. So I was wondering thoughts on the similarities and differences in those things.
So I actually use this example a lot when I'm talking, when I do presentations. I fully agree with you. I think, again, there were probably people at one point who thought they could reform their way out of slavery. Like, let's just, you know, pay them a little something. And we can all agree, hopefully, in this room that that is preposterous.
We just heard from panelists at an Alternatives to Policing panel on December 6th in Detroit. Julie, I understand that at the outset of this event, Jeffrey Lee Edison read a poem which we'd like to play as we close out this show today. Can you please set it up for our listeners?
Jeff Edison is the former chair of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and a prominent and very progressive criminal defense lawyer here in Detroit. He read a poem written by Aneb Gotsitsili, who was formerly known as Dr. Gloria House. Jeffrey has a background in criminal justice, and it's closely involved in reforming our criminal justice system that facilitates the relationship between the school-to-prison pipeline and the mass incarceration of African Americans. Let's take a listen.
Greetings, everyone. It is certainly my honor and privilege to recite to you the sacred words of our beloved sister, comrade, Sister Aneb Gotsitsili. Come, justice. There's a quiet perfections and sweetness in justice. Knowing this, we long for it. We long for it. We pray for it in our daily efforts to end conflict, to invite peace into our circles. We chant for it with the drumming of our heartbeats and our breathing and we hold our ear to the ground, listening for the coming of a new world. But there is war in Ukraine, murderous insanity, havoc and suffering in Uvalde, San Francisco, Haiti, lies and evil of unprecedented magnitude in the everyday news and rush of a crumbling culture. But justice, justice, never abandoning this churning field of misery, awaits the moment of revelation, a blaze of light in this whirlwind of rampaging lawlessness. Sometimes bewildered, sometimes smothered by the gust of cruelty engulfing us, we persevere. We push against all the policies that would imprison us, believing that the flame will break through as it has in the past, in the very moment when our will wavers and strength is gone. We persist, knowing there is a luscious perfection, joy, and peace in those moments when justice redeems our hope and sets the world aright again. Yes, there is luscious perfection, joy, and peace whenever justice comes.
That was Jeffrey Lee Edison reading a poem by the former Dr. Gloria House at the recent panel on alternatives to policing in Detroit. Julie Hurwitz, thank you for hosting this timely and most important panel on a topic that is on the minds of so many in the police reform community.
If listeners want to watch the panel, you can go to the National Lawyers Guild Detroit, Michigan chapter website at michigannlg.org. And that's all lowercase, all one word.
And Julie, we'll be sure to post a link as well on the Law and Disorder website. Julie, thank you for everything that you do and also for being a co-host on Law and Disorder.
And you as well, Heidi.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.